From KALW and PRX, this is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I'm Lauren Schiller.
Almost like prickly about being a female CEO in the early days. And, I think it was at a time when, you know, you would see companies like Dropbox and Airbnb and whatever else. And like, I was like, I just want to be like a CEO, and I don't need to be a female CEO, and I don't need to be the female CEO.
Meet Katrina Lake. If you've got a Facebook feed, there's a good chance you've come across her online personal styling company, Stitch Fix. If you haven't come across this phenomenon, it's like having a personal clothing stylist pick out clothes for you, ship them to your house, and not complain when you send anything back. At age 35 in 2017, Katrina became the youngest female founder and CEO to take a company public. Stitch Fix is now worth over $2 billion. And she got there by breaking the mold of what you might still typically think of when you think of leadership.
I think a lot of the things that you think about as an entrepreneur, you think somebody who's like super risky and somebody who's, going to stay up for all hours, like tinkering with something in their garage. And like, and not that I didn't spend all hours doing Stitch Fix at some point, but, I don't think that I had like the typical traits of an entrepreneur.
Katrina has not only changed the way many of us shop with Stitch Fix, but she's also changing how we think about leaders. For one thing, you may have caught all the press hullabaloo over the picture of her from the NASDAQ IPO when she stood on stage with her young son on her hip, unintentionally setting the tone for a new generation of women leaders. Her executive team is as close to a 50-50 gender split as you can get. And now she plans to send a message, intentionally, about the importance of family leave, because she's pregnant with her second child and is going to take a full 16-week maternity leave.
I had to do the same research of trying to figure out, like, who were the people before me that took a maternity leave when they were a public company CEO. Like, I mean, you can do the math. If I was the youngest female founder and I'm 35, you know, there's not going to be a lot of other examples out there of people who face that. And so there's not a lot of precedent. And so, like, somebody who now is raising young people and is thinking about, like, how the world that you see impacts who people become, there aren't great examples.
I mean, if you want something done right, you have to do it yourself. Case in point. Before starting her own company, Lake was convinced that someone, somewhere, would have developed a new vision for disrupting retail. But after meeting with hundreds of entrepreneurs, she became convinced that the only way to find that company was to start it herself. I spoke with Katrina Lake on stage at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club to find out what makes her tick and how she turned this startup into a successful IPO.
I have to make a confession before we really get into it, which is that I had to change my clothes like 14 times before I got here.
I did too. It's okay.
I don't know about all of you, but it was really hard to decide what to wear, especially when sitting down with a fashion entrepreneur such as yourself. But it made me start thinking about what the role of clothing is for women and men, and the way that we think about it and how it, you know, says who we are. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on what... You know, your entire business is around making sure that people are wearing stuff that they look good and are comfortable in. So how do you think about the role of clothing?
Yeah, it was a major point of inspiration for me. And I think two different angles. So one, like people, there are so few other categories where people really thoughtfully, you know, think about like, oh, I'm coveting this and I want this. And you think about something for weeks and you get inspired by it. And I mean, there's so few other categories. Food is probably one of them also, where you think kind of this, you have the same emotional connection to it. But with clothing, it's just one of these things that, is so important in people's lives and not in a materialistic way, but in this way that like, you know, you thoughtfully decide every every day what you're going to put on your body, and that means something. And so I think that made it very attractive to me, because I think it's just this really interesting, huge category that, you know, people weren't really thinking about. What does technology bring to it, and what's the next generation of it? And then I think the second element that you're getting to a little bit is that, like, it really does have an impact on who you are. And I know this, and I mean, this was shared recently, but I'm now, I don't know, 4 or 5 months pregnant. I'm in that phase where you're like chubby, but not pregnant
right,
yet.
Nothing fits. Congratulations.
And nothing fits. And it's, such a good reminder of the humility of, like, how much I really appreciate when I have clothes that fit and when I know what I want to wear every day. And the reality is, you know, if you're feeling great about who you are, if you're feeling confident about who you are, it really does impact all the touch points in your day. And I think all of us know that feeling of when you're not quite feeling that way, or the flip side is when you are. And, you know, I think how electric that can be, and how in all these little micro moments in your day, it can change your life of, you know, how kind you are to somebody, how kind you are to your kids, like, you know, how outgoing you're going to be, how confident you are when you're at work doing something that's really important. And so, you know, for all those reasons, I love that apparel was, you know, both super meaningful in people's lives. And I think in these really like small but meaningful ways has an impact in people's lives every single day.
So what was happening in your life when you came up with the idea for Stitch Fix?
So it's hard to say exactly when I came up with the idea, but, you know, some history, like growing up, like, you know, as a 10-year-old, if you asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would have told you a doctor. Like, it had never occurred to me that I should want to be an entrepreneur, that I would be a good entrepreneur. You know, you take all these, I forget what they're called, like a Myers-Briggs test. You know, you take these tests when you're growing up, and like zero of them told me I should be an entrepreneur. Like, my mom was a public school teacher here in San Francisco for a long time. My dad was a doctor, but always in the university system. He was here at UCSF for 20 years or so. And so, you know, there is not like an entrepreneurial bone in my body. And so my journey was a little bit of an unconventional one, where I worked at a consulting firm. I did that kind of out of indecision, because I thought I wanted to be a doctor, but I wasn't ready to do that yet. And so I worked at a consulting firm and was lucky enough to kind of stumble into the retail and restaurant practice. And that's where both retail and restaurant I love, because I was like, they're just these big, meaningful categories. And so, you know, the journey was more like I love those categories. And I was like, and I want to work at whatever is going to be the future. And I spent a bunch of time looking to join that company. And so I interviewed a bunch of places. I almost took a job at Starbucks. Ultimately, like, didn't quite feel like that was exactly it. And then I worked at a venture capital firm thinking, okay, this is going to be a great way for me to meet the person who's going to create the future. And so I went and met with, you know, 100 entrepreneurs in my 2 years there, and, you know, didn't meet the person that I thought was going to be the future of retail, but got to meet, you know, 100 people who were all like pretty normal people who were not qualified to be an entrepreneur. And and I realized that, like, you know, any person could be this. And I think, you know, you get exposed to the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Steve Jobs of the world, and, you know, you don't have in your frame of reference, that could be me. Yeah. And, you know, by meeting 100 people, you meet a lot of different types of people. And so I realized I could do it. And so, you know, I think I was really on this journey of, I just want to work at whatever company is reinventing retail in the future. And the formation of Stitch Fix was really just realizing that, like, if I believe there is a different future out there, like, I could start it.
Just create it, just make your own future.
So that was the beginning.
So were you always a shopper? I mean, you know, from an intellectual standpoint, it was interesting to you, but in terms of your own personal, you know, was that something that you either hated doing or loved doing, or?
Maybe both. I don't. I have a sister actually who's here. She's not the shopper either. But, we have the sister who's the age in between us. She was a shopper, and so you know, she was the one who was definitely always the expert. She was always the one taking the fashion risks, and Natalie and I were probably more of the followers and taking her hand-me-downs. But I still, you know, what I still loved, and what I think even people who hate shopping can resonate with, is like, there is nothing better than being able to feel like you have clothes in your closet that you love. And there is nothing better than putting on an outfit and being like, this is a great look. Like, there's nothing better than that feeling. And so, you know, I think I really love that. And I love the ways that clothing could contribute to that. My middle sister literally will, like, she would spend her free time looking at, like, the new arrivals on websites. And, like, that's not really how I spend my free time.
So now you just have a company that has a combination of machines and people doing that for you.
Right. Well, and I think that's part of the inspiration too, is that like there are people who love doing this and who are experts and know everything and in their free time love to do this. And wouldn't it be great to be able to create a job for people like that? And so, you know, that actually ended up being part of the inspiration too.
So how important was going to business school in creating this idea?
So for me, it was important because like I wasn't this super risky entrepreneur type who was going to like I was never going to quit my reasonably well-paying job and like have a gap on my resume. Like that was not something I was comfortable doing. And so for me, it was important because it created this 2-year period of time where I could take this risk. And so I went to business school and my plan was to have a company off the ground, paying myself a salary, paying back my student loans the day I graduated. And if I wasn't able to have a business idea that was good enough that someone was going to give me money, if I wasn't able to have an idea that I wanted to do so that I would, you know, want to spend so far 7+ years on, then, you know, the worst case scenario is like, well, I have this MBA and I can go work at a great company. And so, you know, I saw it as kind of a risk reduced way to start a company. And so, you know, for me, it was really important because I have a hard time imagining how else I would have been able to find kind of a 2-year time period like that. But you know, I think there's a network element that's somewhat valuable. The classes were great. It's so fun to, it's, you know, I think kind of like probably the reason many of you are in this room, like getting to be an adult and go and learn is just like really fun experience and getting to choose what you're going to learn. And, you know, so I definitely valued the experience, but the time was actually the part that I think was most valuable to me.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit more about this idea of risk, because I think people do, you mentioned this a few minutes ago, that people have this idea in their head that entrepreneurs are these massive risk takers and they, you know, anything goes. And in fact, I saw a book just earlier today that said how to raise an entrepreneur. And it was like, teach them to take risks, you know, like all these things that just go counter to what the actual common wisdom is about how you start a successful business, which is not necessarily to just, you know, let it all fly. So can you talk about your mentality around that and what you've run up against in terms of the perception of what an entrepreneur should be?
So first of all, like, I think I am a good leader and a good CEO. And I don't know necessarily that I was a great entrepreneur, to be honest. And, you know, maybe people think of, I mean, I don't know, like, it wasn't kind of where my comfort zone was. Like, I don't sit back, and you'll meet some founders who get to this stage of the company and they yearn the scrappy phases again. And they like the building part. Like, you'll hear that from people. And I did like it, and it was really fun and crazy. But, you know, I don't know that that's the part that I feel like I thrive in. And, you know, we'll probably talk about this later, but like, you could also argue that I wasn't good at it. Like, you know, we've built a $2 billion company using 40 million of capital, not because I was like, oh, I want to raise as little money as possible. Like, it was because I could not raise more than that much money. And so if, you know, in today's world, a good entrepreneur is the one that can raise the most money and hire the most people and buy the most time. And like, you could argue I wasn't good at those things. And, you know, ultimately was actually good at creating a company, which is maybe different. But I hope to be able to be a role model of a different type of entrepreneur, because I think there are lots of women and men out there that, you know, might be thinking to themselves like, well, that's, you know, that's not for me. Like, I can't see myself being that crazy out there person. And I felt the same way. And I think ultimately, like, I actually think I'm good at this job. And I don't know that I would have discovered it had it not been for kind of the convoluted path that I took.
Mm. When you talk about Stitch Fix, I've heard it talked about as a fashion company, a technology company, the intersection of fashion and technology. What is it?
I mean, it is both. And I mean, my theory on the whole thing is just like, I think the world is, we are going to a place where like being a technology company will be table stakes for you to exist. And, you know, the idea of a tech company doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, I think Facebook is a marketing company, Uber is a transportation company, Airbnb is a hospitality company, and we sell clothes. Like, that is our business model. And I think the reality is, like, if you want to be around 10 years from now, if you want to be successful 10 years from now, all of us are going to have to be technology companies. So technology is certainly, you know, what is differentiated about Stitch Fix, what is, I think, what is very special about Stitch Fix. But at the end of the day, like, the business that we're in is retail apparel. Like, actually, I just heard that on the analyst side, on the investor side, that Tesla has now been moved into the auto category for most which makes sense. They make cars.
And where were they before?
They were in technology. Uh-huh. And so there's this weird catch-all bucket of people who've used technology as a differentiator that, like, I think you're going to see more and more of that migrate back into, right? And even Stitch Fix is a stock, like, recovered by mostly tech people, actually, and then a couple of retail people. And, you know, I think you'll see more and more people recognizing that, like, hey, these businesses are, like, you know, they're the same businesses they were before, just powered by technology in a way that we didn't see before. So, you know, I think we're both, but I think the demarcation 10 years from now will probably be retail.
Yeah. So you had these big goals for yourself coming out of business school. Did you meet them right away? I mean, you wanted to pay yourself a salary. You wanted to have a sustainable business.
Not right away, but I was, I really wasn't going to do this if I wasn't paying myself a salary and paying back my student loans. Like, that wasn't just like that wasn't an empty promise. Like, I really wasn't going to do it. And so I was very committed. And so I spent a lot of my second year in business school out here. I spent probably a week or so a month, and sleeping on people's couches and so I was able to get a term sheet from Steve Anderson, who is a seed investor, who is one of the first investors. I saw Kevin on the sizzle reel. Kevin was actually my, a reference check for Steve, the investor. He was the first investor in Kevin at Instagram. And so I was lucky enough to kind of meet him early on. And so he gave us, you know, what would now be considered a very small seed check of $500,000. And so we closed that in April of 2011, started shipping fixes in that month. And then I graduated in May and then kind of moved everything out here in June. And so we closed the money a month before I graduated. So maybe I got in just under the wire. We didn't have a sustainable business model yet at that point. But I was able to pay myself a salary, pay rent, hire some people. And so, I think the other part that was important to me too, and the investor thing was, yes, it was important to raise money, but I think it's also important to have somebody who believes in you invested in the business. And so there's a lot of, confidence and credibility that comes from the fact that an investor who's met a lot of entrepreneurs and seen a lot of companies believes in the business. And, you know, I think one of the things that you can do as an entrepreneur is delude yourself into really believing in something. And sometimes that's great. And sometimes it's not reality. And so, you know, having investors involved, I think also helps, to build confidence that, like, this thing is real and it's possible.
Mm-hmm. How many no's did you have to hear before he said yes?
The seed was relatively easy, I would say, of just like, I think fundraising at Stitch Fix has always been either really hard or really easy and nothing in the middle. With him, I had worked with this woman, Sukhinder Singh Cassidy, who had been an advisor of mine and a mentor of mine, and she introduced me to him. And so that part worked out well. But basically, he was like, he gave a term sheet for $750,000. He was going to put in $500,000, and he said, go find whoever else to fill in the rest of the $250,000. And so I probably talked to, 20 or so people, and everybody else said no. And I was very freaked out that, like, is he going to get cold feet when I go back to him and say nobody else wanted to? And, you know, he actually said, and I think he meant it, he was like, I'm glad that nobody else did. I'm happy to put in the other $250,000. And I was great.
That's amazing.
He was like, it just makes me even happier to see something when other people don't see it, is kind of the way he put it. And so that round we got done. Later rounds, I think, were a little bit more difficult.
Did he tell you what it was he saw? I mean, what it was that made him believe in you?
I mean, at that stage, you know, anybody can come up with this idea. Like, anybody can come up. And Stitch Fix has this great product market fit because, like, when you tell people, like, wouldn't it be great if you could fill out a style profile and have a stylist who would send things to your home and then you can try things on at home and just pay for what you keep? Like, the concept is so strong itself that, you know, I think we benefit from having a lot of just natural product market fit from it. But the flip side of that is anybody can think of that and anybody can pitch that to an investor. I think with Steve, it was really about, like, you know, am I going to be the right person to do it? And honestly, like, I had no experience that should have led him to believe that I was credible. Like, I had no entrepreneurial experience whatsoever. I had, you know, no network of engineers and whoever else to draw from. But, you know, for whatever reason, he felt like I was going to be the one to be able to do it.
Well, congratulations to him and to you for that. Well, I want to go back to you maybe being a doctor at some point when you were 10. So I understand that your mom came to America from Japan to go to graduate school. Did she have that immigrant mentality of like, my daughter must achieve absolutely everything to, you know, live up to the expectations of our new American family? Or, I mean, did you run into any of that as growing up?
I'm looking at my sister. I don't know really that we, you know, I definitely don't think she was, you know, she definitely, I think academics were very important in my family. Like both of my parents really believed that, succeeding in school, that, having a great education would open doors. And so I think that element was definitely very much ingrained. And, in growing up, my mom immigrated here from Japan for graduate school. And so we spoke Japanese growing up. And so in San Francisco, there are schools you can go to so that you can keep up with the Japanese curriculum, because Japan has a national curriculum. And so every Saturday until I was in seventh grade, I think, every single Saturday and then every day in the summer, I went to Japanese school. So I had, you know, I mean, that's like a lot of days of school, if you think about
it. That is. Did you?
Of 365 days, like the vast, vast, vast majority of them were spent, I basically had every Sunday off. That's right. So
that's,
I had 52 days off of school in a year.
Did you resent that?
well, I didn't, you know, I don't, I, yes. The reality is like, I wasn't, there wasn't like anything better that I should have been doing. So, and I don't know, it was so funny too, because it was in the 90s. And so, you know, everybody thought Japanese was going to be so useful. And and it's still useful when I'm in Japan or occasionally in a Japanese restaurant in San Francisco. Yeah. But it wasn't quite the business unlock people thought it would be.
It's not over yet.
But yeah, so I mean, I guess, so it's more just like, you know, I do feel like they instilled the importance of education in us. And so, you know, we definitely worked hard in school and definitely liked succeeding in school. And I think on the family side, like I was very, I don't think I've realized this until kind of being an adult and actually really in the last few years, but I had a lot of exposure to women in my family who'd done amazing things. Part of it is my mom, like, you know, immigrating here and, you know, not knowing English, and she didn't learn to drive until she was like, she'd had two kids in San Francisco. And she was like, well, the bus isn't going to work anymore. And I have to figure out how to drive. And so, you know, I mean, all of that is kind of amazing. And then the longer story is like my mother's mom, so my grandmother was actually the one who really desperately wanted to be an American. And so she had grown up in Japan at a time when she was like a lot, she grew up during the war when Japan was in a very difficult place. And she just always dreamed that like she would see American movies or posters or God knows what the influences were, but she just desperately wanted to be an American. And she was growing up at a time when like women weren't driving, where they had very little opportunity. She was in an arranged marriage. And she actually ultimately did follow my mom after my mom moved here. She followed my mom here and she did actually ultimately become an American. And it's like an amazing thing to think that like of all the things that you think are hard in life, like to live, if you imagine like growing up in Japan in that moment and being able to think to yourself, like someday I'm going to be an American and make that happen is like amazing. And then the other one is on my American side, actually on my Caucasian side, my great grandmother. So it was my grandfather. My grandfather was raised in this very unusual household where my grandfather was basically his mom and her sister both lost their husbands. And this was before welfare. It was before there were social services that were available. And so what these two sisters did was they were like, well, like, we're just going to create a household. Like, I think they had, I need a fact check. I think they had four or five kids between them. And they were like, we're just going to combine our households. And one of us is going to go to work and the other one is going to stay home with the kids. And two sisters are going to raise these kids together. And so my grandfather was the youngest of those. And so he had been raised by these two strong women. He'd never even known his dad. And so like to be able to have these examples in your life of like people doing, you know, anything that I achieve is never going to be as amazing as the things that they did. And it's just a great example to be able to have in your life, because I think it opens up kind of what's possible in a way that is, you know, I really appreciate.
Yeah. Well, do you think that changed his worldview
It totally did. I mean, my grandfather was the one, he like taught me to use a computer. He taught me to drive. Like, you know, I look back now and I can recognize those things as being really cool things that he did. Yeah. But like, I think he came from a place where like, oh yeah, of course, like women are going to do these amazing things. And of course my like, you know, three granddaughters are going to do like whatever they want to do and learn how to do this stuff on a computer. And, you know, I mean, it was just, he definitely had a different perspective than I think a lot of people in his generation did.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to start a new business? Like, what's the one thing that you wish you had known that just nobody bothered to tell you? Or the 10 things. There's probably
Oh God, there's so many. You know, I think there's a bunch of things. Like, I think one, like, this is a very permanent decision. And so as much as you can do of like learning and validating along the way, I think is really valuable, because like, I do think there are times when you can delude yourself into like, well, it's just one more product change and then everybody's going to love it. Or it's just one other thing. And like, you know, I think the more you can really get like concrete points of validation. And I think it's called like lean startup now, which is basically like try to build a shell of what you're going to create and then see if people like it, what do they like about it, and then iterate from there rather than trying to have like a build it and they will come approach. So, you know, I think that's definitely a big one. I mean, this is my personal philosophy, but I don't believe in entrepreneurship for the sake of entrepreneurship. Like, you know, you devote a lot of time and energy and a lot of your life to this, and like, you really have to love it. And so, not to sound like I'm discouraging entrepreneurship, but I think, you know, really making sure you have that like one thing that you really want to devote a lot of your life to. You know, I think, I don't know, people can rush to imperfect ideas and I don't know. So I think that's one thing. And the last, I think, is just like surround yourself with people who are smart that you learn from. Mm-hmm. And that's true if you're an entrepreneur or just a regular person in your career like I was. And, you know, I think there, to be able to surround yourself with people who challenge you, to be able to feel like, you know, I mean, there's nothing worse than stasis and staying the same. Like, I try to figure, I like, it's a hard thing actually these days, and how little I think we get exposed to other perspectives these days. But if you try to think about like, when was the last time I really changed my mind about something important? Like, it's a hard question to answer. And, you know, I love being proven wrong. And at work, I get proven wrong probably more than anywhere else. And I learn from it. And it's, I mean, the only way that you grow is through learning. And so, you know, I think that's just the best advice of like, as you're building a team, as you're building a board, as you're thinking about your advisors, of just really holding the bar high for like people who are going to challenge you, people that you're going to learn from, and people that are going to help you to keep stay on this really steep learning curve.
So you know, as the CEO of a public company, it's kind of this high wire act. Like, almost anything you say could affect the share price, and you don't necessarily even know what that thing is going to be, right? So everyone's listening all the time. And I'm wondering, like, as you think about the, you know, the values that you want to instill in the company and what's important to you and where your priorities are, you know, how do you balance that sort of like, we got to pay attention to what the shareholders want versus we got to pay attention to what's right for the company? And maybe sometimes they don't always match up.
Yeah, I mean, I might have like a Pollyanna view on it, and maybe we're early to this. We've been, you know, public for 3 quarters, but like, I really believe that what the right thing is going to be for the shareholders is also going to be what's right for the company. And you know, I think I don't look at the stock price on a daily basis, you know, for better or for worse. I don't know what the fluctuations are or what causes them. The long term, where we go in the long term is definitely important. And I think a lot of the things that we do are really looking at how can we make sure that we can create the most value for ourselves, for our shareholders, for our clients. You know, I think the other brilliant thing about like our model that I love is that there's this amazing alignment. Like in our business model, the more I can send you clothes that you love, the happier you are and the better our business is. And so there's this like really, really great alignment that you don't always have. Like if you think about Google's business model, for example, like the more ads they can show, the more ads they can get people to click on, like the better their business is. And like as a consumer, like you don't really want to see all the ads. You just want to use Gmail. So like there's this interesting, I think, you know, kind of dance that a lot of executives have to walk. talk of just like what's good for the business versus what's good for the customer. And I have this like amazing advantage where it's very aligned in a lot of cases. And so like it helps us in prioritizing because, you know, if we can just focus on how can we help people to find what they love and how can we help people to find more of what they love. And like it just makes it really clear of like what we need to do to create value. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that they are the same thing and that, you know, we won't have to feel like a lot of conflict of short term versus long term. But you know, I think so far we've been, you know, when we talk to investors and you spend time with investors, and it is actually in a lot of ways just like being a private company. Like there are investors that I can talk to at certain times and hear their perspectives. And you know, I think it's my job to make sure that everybody knows what that long term vision is and to, you know, to make sure that people all see it and believe it.
We have so many entrenched ideas about how a company should be run because they've mostly been run by men of a certain age and hair color, or hoodie. But Katrina Lake has been finding lots of ways to disrupt business as usual, whether she intends to or not. And her vision for Stitch Fix has paid off so far. But it also comes with a spotlight on her every move.
Like there's just these weird conversations around like, well, what do you do with earnings when you're on maternity leave?
That's coming up after the break. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point. This conversation with Katrina Lake, the founder and CEO of Stitch Fix, was recorded live at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club.
I mentioned at the very beginning of this the iconic photo of you at the NASDAQ with your son on your hip. And it was a head turner, you know, and are you tired of headlines that focus on taking your company public and being a new mom? Or just recently there was a headline, Stitch Fix CEO Katrina Lake talks about leading a public company and her upcoming maternity leave.
I mean, my perspective on it has changed over time. So I had some pride about me, I think, that prevented me from embracing that early. And you know, this is more on reflection of like looking back and thinking like, well, why did I not think I could be an entrepreneur? And now I just think it's so important. And so even if it's just like, I'm just an example, like I think it's good and I'm happy to be that example. And like I said, you know, I hope there's going to be many more people after me that can, you know, be, it's totally normal for like, there's just these weird conversations around like, well, what do you do with earnings when you're on maternity leave and you're a public company CEO? There are all these things that like, I don't really know what the right answers are. And, you know, I'm going to try to figure it out. But there just need to be more, I think just having more examples of what, you know, different types of stories look like and different possibilities look like is super important.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those sort of can't win situations in some ways, right? Cause like Marissa Meyer got dinged for only taking a couple of weeks of maternity leave. And you're probably going to get dinged for taking the entire maternity leave. I mean, it's like,
well, and these situations are all really different because, you know, I think when Marissa Meyer was in her place, like, I think she had like activist shareholder issues. She had, you know, like she had a company on fire situation. And so, you know, was that the right thing to do when your company is on fire? And this is the problem is that there's so few examples that like I was with a public company CEO literally last week who he has a 6-week old at home and he is taking his paternity leave. And so he was like happy to meet me at brunch, like wearing like golf clothes and shorts and he was on his paternity leave. Yeah. So like, you know, I think all of these situations are unique and, you know, it's you can't fault, I think, one person for having a different choice, but you know, the challenge is that there's really only two situations now that you're going to be able to look back on. And, you know, if I think for many other men, there's hundreds. So, you know, hopefully this can add to what people think of as, you know, what are my options when I'm in this situation?
So where's your husband in all this? Does he like, it used to be like, I remember, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, like Carly Fiorina, like when she was running HP, the whole story was about how her husband was at home taking care of the baby. And that's how they made it possible because they inverse the typical relationship. So do you and your hubby ever talk about, you know, divvying up the responsibilities so you can both do your thing?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely do. And he's not at home taking care of the kids as his job full time. That's not like we have a nanny and she's wonderful. And so, but that being said, like, you know, and I think to myself, like, am I being sexist in thinking this? Because like, it's less about this year. Like I travel quite a bit, but as I think about next year and I think about, we're going to have two kids and one's going to be a toddler and one will be an infant. And I have this like enormous guilt around like, oh, that seems really hard. And for me to be traveling and leaving him to deal with two kids at night, even if he's not taking care of them during the day, like it's a lot of work at nights and the mornings. And I would like think to myself, like, am I sexist in thinking that? Because there's many men before me that had wives that traveled and left their two kids with their wife and probably didn't think twice about it. And I still like, I still haven't figured out like, how are we going to do that next year? And so, you know, I think I'm very, very lucky and grateful that I have a husband that's very supportive and a husband that, you know, probably takes more of the mornings and nights than I do. But I do, and I do think like in this world, like it does take, you know, it does take somebody who is willing to kind of put in, you know, a little bit more, I think to, and, you know, I don't think it's necessarily that you need somebody who's going to be like a complete, you know, kind of stay home parent or anything. But I do think like the reality is that it's hard. And, you know, the reality is like there's sacrifices that one or the other is going to be making every single day. And then just, you know, trying to figure out how you can do that and then have a healthy relationship with your kids and a healthy relationship with your spouse. And, you know, it's all puzzle pieces that aren't super easy.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've surrounded yourself with a great team that come from a variety of big brand backgrounds in Netflix and Google, and I don't know, Lululemon was in there somewhere. And do you have a mentor? Like, do you have that one person that you can turn to and be like, I can't ask anyone else this question?
I do. And I think, and I've had many throughout my journey, and I would say I have different people that I turn to for different topics. And so actually one of the things that I think has been really fun and unexpected about being a public company was that like, it's not like I had lots of public company CEOs that I knew, like, you know, I had met a couple, like I really didn't know any. And it was really amazing how people kind of came out of the woodwork and helped. Like there was like, you know, now it's all water under the bridge, but our roadshow process, the process of getting public was like, it was difficult. It's like in the bucket of when I say fundraising has either been really hard or really easy. And the IPO process was really hard. And, you know, we weren't kind of seeing the traction that we wanted to see. We weren't, you know, getting people bought into the story in the way that we needed to. And so, and I had like a public company CEO who through an investment banker was like, hey, if she needs to talk, tell her to call me. And it was somebody I'd never met before who had been through the process and kind of knew exactly how I was feeling in that moment. And there's been other, I think others also who've kind of reached out since. And so I've been really, you know, I think that was a network that I didn't necessarily knew existed and where I didn't feel like I was part of it before that just kind of emerged to be helpful. That's been great. But, you know, I think I have my board, actually, I have a lot of great people on my board who I turn to a lot. And over the course of the last 7 years, I've been lucky enough to kind of build a network of, in a lot of cases, other CEOs and people who are in the space and not in the space who are going through similar things that, you know, I can talk to and get advice from. And, you know, I think I've been very fortunate that there are a lot of women that I've met also along the way who like are very happy to make time for me whenever I ask. And so, you know, it's certainly something that I hope to be able to repay the favor for.
Well, what do you look for? Because I know you're involved in a few things that are female focused in terms of investments. And I've got the Female Investment Fund, something called Moving Forward, which is about diversity. But in terms of when you now look at other companies that are looking for investments, what do you look for?
What do I look for? I mean, I don't do a ton of investing, but I mean, it is really important to me that founders that I meet and kind of companies I'm involved in are committed to building diverse teams. And I mean, that, you know, that has a women angle, but I think it's much broader than a women angle of like, I think one of the things at Stitch Fix that has made the company great is the diversity of team and perspectives that we have. And so the fact that we have data scientists who are sitting next to stylists and being like, why are you picking that one? Wait, why did you not pick that one? I don't understand what's going on in your mind. And they just fascinated and really have this great respect for the job that they do. And I think, you know, part of what's amazing about Stitch Fix is that I don't know that there's ever been like a data scientist who sat down with a stylist and like got into their brain about why they're choosing clothes. And so, you know, I think we've really benefited from the diversity of people and perspectives that we have. And I think it's really important for founders to start with that. And I think one of the bigger challenges of why we see so little diversity at the top and at technology technology companies is because so often founding teams are built by repeat founders who go back to their network to build the team. And so they're just perpetuating this kind of lack of diversity that has existed in the industry for 20 years. And, you know, no one's putting up a job posting for a co-founder. Like, you know, you're just drawing from people in your network. And so, so I think, you know, as I have the chance to meet with founding teams, like I push on it a lot. I push on it with their board. I push on it with, you know, I've noticed you don't have any women on your founding team. What is your commitment on that? And so, you know, I think that's an area that I think helps to make companies better. And I think also kind of creates a better ecosystem for all of us.
Well, let's talk about your team and, you know, and how you are, how the values that you're espousing are playing out inside your company around diversity. So your executive team is 50-50, men and women. I actually went to your website and I counted, and it's true. It really is true. But most of your on-the-ground employees are women. And I think 86%, is that about right?
If you include, yeah, the number's a little hard because if we have a 3,500 stylist organization and the vast majority of our stylists are women. So these are women who are working part-time, mostly work from home. And so that skews the number to make it 80-something overall company-wide. But then we also have 1,500 warehouses where it's about 50-50. Our headquarters, I think, is about 60-40 women to men. So if you put in the 3,500 stylists into our 6,000 employee figure, then it becomes very skewed sounding, but on average, it's about like, you know, it's a little over parity where we have women a little more represented than men.
Well, one of the things I've been thinking about is like, we already know what the downsides are of a culture dominated by men. And so I've just been thinking about, well, what happens when you have a company that's kind of dominated by women? Like what, you know, what's the outcome there?
I mean, firstly, like I would contest that it's like a culture dominated by women. It's like, you know, our board, our management team is 50-50. Our board is 60-40 women. Our headquarters is 60-40 women. Like, I don't think that's dominated by women. And I don't think that you would ask a male CEO who is progressive enough to have a, you know, 40% or 50% female management team. Like you would never ask him about a culture that's dominated by men. I think it's,
like, I might now. I mean, maybe not 5 years ago, but now I definitely would. I'm just curious. I'm not saying that that's what your situation is, but just sort of philosophically speaking, you know, if there's any sort of upsides or downsides to having, well, even just having it at 50-50 is in a sense more dominated by women than it has been in the past.
Yeah, oh, unquestionably it is more so. I don't know. I mean, I think the downside is that I get questions like that, not in an insulting way, but in a way that like, it's not obvious to other people. Like yeah. That it's not something people are experiencing all the time. So it becomes something that is unusual. And like, you know, I think that's unfortunate because like, I think there's a lot of upside to it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of upside to it from just like having different perspectives and diversity. I think there's also, I mean, we were just talking about parenting, so it's top of mind for me. I think there's also a lot of upside from the perspective of people who are men and women who are, you know, trying to live a life and work. And you know, I think there's a lot more conversations and there's a lot more kind of empathy that happens when you see both sides of the equation every day at work. So, you know, I don't know. I think it's also maybe all I know. So maybe I can't speak to the downsides or the upsides, but I think we've been able to create a place that people love to work and that, you know, has been able to take, you know, kind of this, what people academically talk about as being important in diversity and actually show like, this is what it looks like and this is how it works. And this is an example of it in a way that I don't know that we've seen, had a lot of examples before.
All right. I have one last question for you, which is an informed tradition, which is, no pressure, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
I don't know that I have a specific idea, but like I think that one of the things that has been a real challenge, and you can see it in the kind of political landscape also, is just in the loss of community. And so I think even just like this group of people getting together to do something like this in an evening is a really great part of that. And I think there's been like a, you know, just kind of a loss of humanization of a lot of the things that we do. And so, you know, when we're buying things, when we're, the way that we engage with each other, like a lot of it has been kind of dehumanized in a way that I think has taken away from communities. And so, you know, I don't know what the exact idea is, but ways that you can bring more commerce into the communities, ways that you can make things like buying clothes a more human experience and a more human-to-human experience, I think brings back the humanness that connects us as a country and as a community. And, you know, I think a lot of, especially in e-commerce, it's become very anonymous and very transactional. And I think that the harms of that are greater than what we're seeing in terms of the impact that it's having on how we think about each other and how we think about the space that we occupy together. So I'd love to see anything that kind of just brings back a sense of community and brings communities together in more human ways.
Katrina Lake's company, Stitch Fix, is often described as being at the intersection of fashion and technology. But at the end of the day, she's using technology to solve one of the oldest problems in the book. What am I going to wear? And she's doing it by putting people first. But it's bigger than just how we shop for clothes. She sees a problem with the lack of diversity in tech and makes sure her company is an example of how diversity makes good business sense. She sees a problem with the lack of parental leave and has made her dedication to family as much a part of her public identity as her extraordinary success. I look forward to the day when Katrina's success and her dedication to a diverse and family-friendly workplace is no longer extraordinary. It's just how business is done. This is How Women Rise Up. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to support Inflection Point with a monthly or one-time contribution. Your support keeps women's stories front and center. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at LA Schiller. To find out more about the guests you heard today and to sign up for our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.